Chapter 17. The 5-minute warning had elapsed long ago, but they'd been too busy kissing to pay any attention. As the library's overhead lights shut off, Michael and Kelsey scooped up their textbooks and scurried down to the lobby, calling out to the night warden to not lock them in. He waited with the door open, an expression of polite disapproval. Being the last people out most nights, they had developed a degree of familiarity with the warden, who thankfully was a patient man. They wished him well before ambling towards the tram stop. Kelsey stroked Michael's arm as they walked hand in hand down the cobbled street. Michael had grown to love that path, with its bumpy surfaces, ancient brick, and quaint gas lamps, not to mention the girl he walked it with. Normally, the pair abstained from makeout sessions while studying, or at least Kelsey abstained, and Michael respected the rules. His grades had certainly improved since they'd gotten together.
"I appreciate how patient you've been with me," she said, giving him a squeeze.
"Isn't this how all couples date?
Libraries and no-touching rules on a Friday night," chuckled Michael. "I'm finding this first semester tough, and I know it's making me a buzzkill. Believe me, in another world, you and I would be drinking wine on a beach, but right now I've got to stick to the plan."
"It's a solid plan.
Who's going to make the world a better place if not you?"
She rested her head on his shoulder.
"Who's looking after your grandfather tonight?"
It's Mom's turn."
"Why?" "There's a mid-semester break next week, which means tomorrow's homework can wait."
"Are you telling me Kelsey, the library creature, has a free weekend?" She nodded, pulling him into a passionate kiss. They caressed each other sensuously, then broke away with an oxytocin-fueled gasp of satisfaction.
"So how about it?" she said, running her hands through his hair.
"How about what?"
"Coming back to my place tonight."
Michael's eyes lit up like it was Christmas. His utter inability to play it cool made Kelsey adore him even more, as she laughed in his face. He nibbled her lip, and the pair stumbled towards the tram shop, drunk with love. He was so content, so wrapped up in his affection for her, that he didn't notice the tall, metallic figure gliding through the shadows behind them. Kelsey's apartment was immaculate. Michael kicked off his shoes as instructed and swiped into the guest space on her senses. The place smelled brand new and gleamed like a show home.
"Man, I need a ministry job," he chuckled. "I could never afford this place on my intern salary. This is the consolation prize for getting trapped in a mine and having my bones broken. It's a sweet deal. I'd recommend it to anyone willing to asphyxiate in darkness 2 miles underground."
Michael looked at her, puzzled.
"Have I not told you about that?"
"That'll be a good story for breakfast."
She pulled out a bottle of red wine from the cupboard and 2 elegant glasses.
"It's beautiful in here. So composed.
It's very you," said Michael.
Kelsey sidled back to him and placed her hands on his chest.
"Well, aren't you just saying all the right things? I'm glad you approve. You're the first person to see it," she said, giving him a kiss.
"I'm honored," he replied.
"You're horny and on your best behavior," she laughed, pressing against him.
"You got me there," grinned Michael as they fell onto the sofa.
Michael awoke with a jolt and checked the bedside clock. It was 5:55 a.m. He extricated himself from Kelsey's sleeping embrace and crept to the kitchen lounge area, pulling on his clothes. He hunted for her house keys. They weren't anywhere obvious. He glanced at the clock on the wall, 5:56 a.m. He frantically patted down the jackets hanging in the hallway, 5:57 a.m. Cursing under his breath, he scoured the kitchen, searching every drawer, 5:58 a.m. He crept back into the bedroom and rummaged through her purse, 5:59 a.m. "Come on, come on," he muttered, rushing to the bathroom. As he rifled through the cabinet, a bottle of mouthwash fell, smashing to the floor. Kelsey called out, startled.
"Michael, what's going on?"
She opened the door to find him standing in a pool of aqua blue and glassy shards, searching the cupboard like nothing had happened.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Her wristwatch chimed 6 a.m.
"Where's your mailbox key?" he snapped.
His eyes were wired, his tone panicked. Kelsey frowned, perplexed, and reached for her purse. To her dismay, it was lying on the floor, among the other contents of her drawer.
"Did you go through my stuff?" she snapped. There's no time. The key!
She opened a secret compartment and handed it over, bewildered.
Michael, what's going on?
He sprinted for the door, leaving blue footprints in his wake. Hastening down the central staircase, he raced to the building's stack of mailboxes. With trembling fingers, he found Kelsey's and wrenched it open.
Are you going to tell me what this is about?
Demanded Kelsey, catching up. Michael staggered back from the mailbox and slumped against the opposite wall, staring at the empty hatch.
Hey, I'm talking to you.
She slammed the box shut and pocketed the key. Michael's eyes refocused on her face.
I had to check, you know. No, Michael, I don't. Would you care to explain?
If my letter had come, or yours. I was worried. I'm always worried. I had to know, and now I do, so we can go back to bed, and it's fine. Today is fine.
Hold up. You're telling me you do this every day. Are you insane?
Is it insane to value each day? Snapped Michael. He looked tired, gaunt. How had she never noticed those bags under his eyes?
You're getting up at the crack of dawn to check if you're gonna die. I wouldn't call that normal behavior, Michael. Aren't you relieved? He said, panting. No! I'm disturbed that my boyfriend has some weird obsession with death. What I'm doing makes perfect sense. Maybe you don't value your life as much as I value mine.
Kelsey blinked, taken aback.
I beg your pardon? I don't value my life? I work 13 hours a day, 6 days a week, balancing a demanding job and intensive studies because I want to make something of my life. I'm not the one drifting through school without a plan.
It's easy for you to say. You don't know what I'm dealing with, said Michael.
Nothing has been easy for me. Don't you for a second think you're the only one with baggage. If there's stuff you want to work through, we can do that. But you have to talk.
Talk? To who? You?
The person who's buried in her book every time we hang out? Who's too busy to go to the movies or get a milkshake or just be normal? Maybe think about what you're offering before you take the high road.
The pair glared at each other, equally incensed.
I think this was a mistake, said Kelsey, pointing between the two of them.
I think so too, snapped Michael.
You should go.
Fine. He pushed open the lobby door and glared at her, with tears forming in his eyes. She stared back at him with cold revulsion and folded arms as he left. Drying his cheeks, Michael got off the tram. He tried his best to recite the anger in his mind, but all he felt was shame. It was around 6:40 a.m. and his street was deserted. All his neighbors were tucked up enjoying a Saturday morning lie-in, apart from a mall. As Michael approached his family home, he could see his grandfather propped up in front of the television. Michael looked from the old man to the mailbox. With trepidation, he opened the latch, revealing a bundle of letters. Seizing them, he rifled through with trembling hands. Sighing with relief, he slumped against the post, clutching the pile of bills and holiday postcards from distant relatives. He pattered inside, taking a seat beside his granddad. Amal pointed to the band of marauding cowboys on screen with a chinky glint.
They're about to get spanked by the locals, he chuckled before seeing Michael's face.
Michael, what's wrong? You look like hell.
You know who I am? Said Michael, astonished.
I like to think I know you pretty well, smiled Amal. What's eating you at 6 a.m? Ah, I know that puppy dog face. You've had a lover's quarrel. Bad luck. They've all been there.
Have you? Mom always said you and Grandma were the perfect couple.
Perfection takes work. Take these movies, for instance. Your grandmother hated westerns. I could only watch them when she was out, which meant taping them. For her part, she was obsessed with model railways and stuffed her garage to breaking point with the damned contraptions. She would slave over them whenever she had a spare moment, which was rare, given that we were lumped with 4 children. Did I say lumped? I meant lumped. Yep, right the first time, he chuckled.
When you and Grandma fell out, how did you fix it?
The same way you fix anything. Figure out what the actual problem is. Then talk it through until you find the solution together. The most important thing you can ever do is admit when you're wrong. If you are unable to do that, it means you're either lying to your partner, or worse, lying to yourself, and neither of those paths lead to a good place. Are you seeing this girl seriously, or is it just a bad date?
We're a couple. Or we were, at least. I screwed it all up, said Michael.
I've had my share of screw-ups. Try me. I'll let you know where yours fit on the scale.
A horse whinnied on screen as the sole surviving cowboy fled the ambush. Michael contemplated, unsure where to begin.
I'm scared of dying, he blurted finally.
Amal chuckled,
then realized he was serious.
Oh, okay. Why?
Same reason as anyone. I don't want to lose what I have.
Are you seeing the irony, kid?
But I had to check the mail to know if I was going to...
die?
Yeah.
And?
No, not today anyway.
Okay, so that's a bonus. But what would you have done if your letter had been there?
This dumbfounded Michael. In all his fear of discovering a letter, he'd never thought about what he might do if it actually came.
I don't know.
Wrong,
the old man sighed, flicking off the TV.
The correct answer is, say your goodbyes, be grateful to those you love, and accept your time with dignity. It's the only course of action.
Maybe, Michael says, staring at the carpet.
Okay. It's time, said Amal. I told your mother you needed to know a long time ago, but she was terrified you'd become just like your father. Clearly, redacting the past hasn't worked. You're growing more like him every day. But that doesn't mean you need to make his mistakes.
What are you talking about?
His grandfather took a deep breath and looked Michael in the eye.
When you were born, your father changed. He was a kind-hearted, loving man, and you always meant the best. But once he had you, his worldview shifted. He was subtle at first, because he could hide it. Whether he was in denial or ashamed, I don't know, but it didn't last. Within a few years, he was a shadow of himself. He was anxious, sleep-deprived, and on edge the whole time. He dreaded the evenings, because they meant morning was approaching. He checked the mail every day at the crack of dawn, robbing himself of sleep. Once he knew his fate for the day, he would loosen up, only to tighten with each hour that passed. To catch him in a jovial mood, it was breakfast or nothing. Things worsened when your sister arrived. He suddenly had even more to lose, and he became intensely protective of the pair of you. One day, not too long after her birth, his letter came. And he made the worst choice of his life.
Michael stared at the old man, open-mouthed. All these years, both his grandfather and his mother had buried the truth from him.
What did he do? Whispered Michael.
He hid it.
Michael looked at him, perplexed.
Hid his death letter? What even happened?
For one, it meant none of us knew his time was up. We all carried on as normal, thinking life was dandy. But he started acting even more neurotically than normal. He'd take you to school, then hang around outside the gates all day, barely putting your sister down even to walk. He'd drop by your mom's office unannounced, pretending he was visiting a client nearby. But he'd quit his job already and was just trying to eke out precious time with her.
Can people do that? Ignore their letters? Asked Michael.
His eyes were wide, his tone earnest, two facts that did not escape his grandfather's attention.
In all my years, he is the only person I have known who was fool enough to try, and I know he regretted it. As with all things, Michael, there is a price to pay. The ministry worked to keep life and death in balance, and your father broke the equilibrium. He only had himself to blame for what happened, for...
Michael stared at Amal anxiously.
For what? Granddad?
The old man's eyes had glossed over. His face softened. His shoulders dropped, and he stared through his grandson's chest. Michael grabbed Amal's arms and rubbed them, trying to rouse him.
"Granddad? Please, I need to know what happened to Father. Please!"
begged Michael. But Amal was gone. Only faint, nonsensical mutterings about pancakes escaped his whispering lips. Michael leaned into the old man's shoulder and wept. As he did so, the locks on the front door clicked open. Michael looked up, bewildered. No one was missing from the census when he'd arrived. A tall shadow approached the threshold. Michael's mouth dropped open as an automaton glided into the living room, the same one that had chased him before, with the unmistakable mottled blue stains across half its bronze face. It froze, extending a silent arm towards Michael and his grandfather. Michael leaped to his feet, wielding a cushion. The automaton continued to point. Michael followed the machine's eyes to his dribbling grandfather.
"No, please don't take him. I beg you,"
moaned Michael. The automaton shook its head. With its other hand, it opened a compartment on its torso and withdrew a small rectangular strip of something glass-like. It presented the piece for Michael to examine. It was a sequela. The symbols matched those he'd seen before.
"Is this the same one?"
he asked nervously. The automaton gave a mechanical nod. Placing the glass between its fingers and thumb, it snapped the top half open. Inside was a super-thin sheet of something translucent, bearing his grandfather's symbols. The automaton glided closer to the old man. Michael made a desperate lunge at the machine, but it blocked him with a single arm. Pinning Michael aside, the automaton held the strip beneath Amal's nose. The old man sniffed. Something flickered across his face. His mouth opened, and he stuck out his tongue. The automaton placed the gelatinous wafer onto it, and Amal swallowed. The color returned to his cheeks at once, and he sat up straight in his chair. Staring the automaton dead in the eye, Amal said simply,
"Thank you."
With a nod, the machine released Michael, who crawled away gasping.
"Michael?
It's me, Granddad,"
he cried, scurrying to Amal's lap.
I can see that, my boy. I'm asking what's wrong.
Are you cured?
Maybe. Do I look like a block of ham?
The return of his grandfather's terrible sense of humor answered Michael's question, at least for the time being.
I'm aware of my predicament, if that's what you mean, dear boy. What's with the machine?
I don't know. It put something in your mouth and you came back. I think it's on our side.
Our side? My boy, who do you think's against us?
Fate?
Fate is neither for nor against us, Michael. It's beside us and around us, like the air we breathe. Don't fight it. Let it flow through your hair like a summer breeze and enjoy the riches it brings. Do you like that? I read it on a fortune cookie once. Delicious stir-fry, if I recall.
Granddad, do you remember what we were talking about before the automaton revived you?
I do now,
he muttered.
You said my father made a mistake with his letter.
Amal's expression turned to deepest sorrow.
You said Father hid it. What happened then?
Urged Michael. Amal eyed his grandson in the automaton.
As our metal friend here will attest, non-compliance comes at the price. Often, it is not the perpetrator who pays the price, but those around them. Your father kept his letter hidden for 5 days. Eventually, a mob appeared at the house. 5 of them were clutching black letters, distraught. They kicked the door down and seized your father. Your mother didn't know what was happening. She called the police, who, at the time, included her old man. I arrived with the dispatch team and knew what we were dealing with right away. It wasn't something anyone in our precinct had experienced firsthand, just something they taught us at the academy, which we had dismissed as folklore. But there it was, happening right before my eyes. The mob smashed the windows, destroyed the furniture, and seized your father. He was beat up pretty bad by the time we got there. My colleague and I dispersed the crowd, but there was no denying their letters. I confronted your father, and he broke down. He admitted to burying his letter in the backyard. I retrieved it, and told him to say his goodbyes. You were away at the time at the friend's house, and your sister is too young to remember what happened, but I know your mother carries it around with her every day. I see glimpses of it in her eyes. The sadness, the anger, the shame. I don't know that she's ever been able to forgive him.
What were the black letters? I've never heard of them, said Michael.
When a child is assigned, the parent or parents receive a white letter bearing its name. Most families don't realize the ministry can take those letters back. For every day that a living adult resists their own death letter, a black letter is dispatched. Accordingly, an expectant family loses their unborn child. It took 5 days for the grieving families to track your father down and attempt to drag him to the ministry themselves. As it was, I took him in a police car. His deadline was long gone, and every minute risked another child's life. In the end, he barely had time to say goodbye to your mother or sister. When it was over, I returned to your mother. She was hysterical, overcome by guilt and the shame of his actions. Relocating was the only way to shake the stigma that it brought. We moved to this city that same week and started over.
Why did he do it? Breathed Michael.
You tell me, kiddo, said Amal with a sad smile.
As the front door clicked open, 3 robed automatons glided into the room. Michael shrank to the floor in fear. Amal stayed perfectly still, his lips parted, his eyes tracking the machine's movements. The front automaton seized the rogue unit by the neck and raised it from the ground. Whirring mechanical noises rang out, but the machine offered no resistance. The other automaton seized its arms. With a crunch, they tore them off, before ripping its legs from their sockets. The central automaton plucked the victim's head from its torso and dropped it among the rest of its body parts. With extreme efficiency, the 3 shredded its remains, tearing each component apart. The lead automaton ripped open its breastplating, revealing a core of cogs and levers. At the center was a glowing red and amber hunk of stone 5 inches wide. As they wrenched it from the machine's torso, the light behind its marble eyes flickered out. The 3 assassins rose to their feet and stared at Amal. The old man met each machine's gaze with a defiant dignity until one by one they glided from the room. As soon as the last machine was gone, he exhaled with relief and slumped back into his seat. Michael sprang to the curtain and watched the automatons disappear down the street, his heart in his throat.
Help me clear this up before Mom sees it, he urged. I don't want to be explaining this to her.
You mean you know why this happened?
Said Amal faintly.
Granddad, I messed up, okay? I messed up real bad. On my 18th birthday, I chose a letter, then I changed it.
How? That's impossible.
The automaton glitched. I think it hinted that my first choice was a bad one. Fatal, maybe. So I took it back. Then we struggled and the machine broke. So I put a different letter in my locker and burned the others, then ran. And ever since that happened, you've...
suffered,
said Amal wistfully. Michael nodded.
I've tried so many times to fix it, I swear. I've been to the ministry, but they wouldn't listen. I tried giving myself up in your place.
He trailed off, ashamed. Amal looked at him, aghast.
Michael, your life is a precious thing. To throw it away on my account would be madness. I'm an old fart. My letter's long overdue. Precipitating yours to save off mine is delusional. Think of the harm it would do to your mother.
But I have to put it right, protested Michael.
Controlling events won't change your death, but it will ruin your life. You're not immune from injury. There are innumerable ways you could inflict lasting pain upon yourself. Wake up, kid. Promise me you'll stop this madness, or it'll end up like this thing.
As Amal gestured to the mutilated machine, a shuffling rumbled upstairs. Someone was awake. Michael hurried to the cupboard and retrieved a large suitcase. He and Amal threw the pieces inside before Michael dragged it upstairs as quietly as he could. He hid the mass under his bed,
then hastily changed and showered. When he returned downstairs, it was to the sound of laughter. Amal was making pancakes, and his mother and sister were enjoying flowing conversation of a sort they'd not shared in weeks.
"Michael, take a seat. Look who's on amazing form today," beamed Val.
"He can't stop. There's somewhere else he needs to be, isn't that right, kid?"
said Amal with a knowing smile.